Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, quote, "She took the family to McDonald's because they liked it, even though she knew they couldn't afford to eat out. She went through more pain pills than she needed, and every few weeks, when those pills ran low, like today, she returned to the doctor for more." Close quote. That's some of what the Washington Post thinks you should know about the mother in a family that relies on Social Security disability insurance. The paper is doing a series on disability benefits, and so far it's exactly like that fragment suggests. And if you like bad data, along with your mean-spirited anecdote, the Post has you covered there as well. We'll talk with Rebecca Vallis of the Center for American Progress about the many problems and the potential impact of this kind of reporting. Also on the show, politicians and pundits made hay with congressional candidate Karen Handel's comment that she did not support a livable wage. But while the phrasing was inelegant, the Georgia Republican didn't really misspeak. And it's a bit rich for corporate media to claim to find remarkable a position they've spent plenty of time entertaining. We discussed the merits of that position on a previous show with economist Holly Sklar. She runs a group called Business for a Fair Minimum Wage and is author of, among other titles, Raise the Floor: Wages and Policies That Work for All of Us. We'll hear again from Holly Sklar on the myths around a living wage. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. As we record this show, we don't yet know the results of the UK's June 8th early general election. We do know, with certainty, what outcome Britain's big media would like to see. As Ben Norton documented for Fair.org, the corporate press in the UK have spared little in attacks on Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, a longtime anti-war activist and party outsider. For a taste, the election day cover of Rupert Murdoch's Sun begged voters, "Don't chuck Britain in the core bin," with a picture of the candidate in a garbage can, and phrases like "terrorist's friend," "destroyer of jobs," "nuclear surrender," "ruinous spending," and "open immigration." Over here, outlets like the New York Times were more sophisticated. The paper's June 3rd story, "For Britain's Labour Party, a mild defeat may be worst of all," told readers that a Corbyn victory would be nothing short of disaster for Labour's less ideological, more politically ambitious lawmakers. More an op-ed than a report, the piece made clear its opposition was not just to Corbyn, but to his ideas. It quoted a critic who mourned that even though Labour will likely lose, quote, "I don't think it will be bad enough. There will be too many loopholes, so people can say, okay, Jeremy wasn't popular, but the policies are fine," close quote. Not a single source had anything positive to say, which must have left readers wondering why Corbyn's popularity steadily increased throughout the campaign. After the Daily Telegraph leaked what it called Labour's left-wing manifesto in May, the report led, "Jeremy Corbyn will take Britain back to the 1970s by nationalizing industries, forcing wage caps on businesses, and giving huge power to the unions." Many voters responded positively. By May 25th, a poll found that Labour had closed the gap to within just 5% of the Tories. This week marks the 50th anniversary of what's called in Israel and the U.S. the Six-Day War and An-Nakba, or the setback, in Palestine, a conflict that marked the beginning of a decades-long occupation of Gaza and the West Bank by the Israeli military. A survey by FAIR analyst Adam Johnson finds that in opinion pieces analyzing the conflict and its subsequent effect on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, major U.S. media favored Israeli and pro-Israel American voices at the expense of Palestinians by a wide margin. Looking at opinion pieces in major U.S. papers and magazines, Johnson found 23 out of 26 voices were Israeli or American, while only 3 were Palestinian or Palestinian-American. Counting ethnicities or nationalities isn't a perfect instrument, of course, but it's a way to illustrate whose voices are being amplified and whose are not. The findings are in keeping with a fair study of the New York Times back in April that showed pro-Palestinian voices and those supporting the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement are overwhelmingly and consistently outnumbered on the paper's opinion page by anti-BDS and pro-Israel commentators. And finally, Donald Trump's withdrawal of the U.S. from the Paris Climate Change Accord was widely denounced. "Unconscionable and fatuous," proclaimed The Economist. "Trump shamefully abandons the fight against humanity's greatest threat," wrote Bloomberg News. But the thing is, when they've had the chance over the past 4 months of his presidency to ask Trump a question on climate change, no outlet has bothered to bring it up. The Washington Post and New York Times editorial interviews with candidate and president-elect Trump, respectively, did ask him about his climate change views. But Fair could not find a single question about climate change in any interview or press conference with Trump since he took office on January 20th. Media Matters' annual study found that in 2016, evening newscasts and Sunday shows on ABC, CBS, and NBC, as well as Fox News Sunday, aired not one segment informing viewers of what to expect on climate policy under a Trump or Clinton administration. And separately, Media Matters' Matt Gaetz pointed out that at the White House press briefing after Trump's announcement, EPA head Scott Pruitt read from what he called a very important piece from the New York Times' new climate skeptic columnist, Brett Stevens, which Pruitt said was evidence in support of Trump's decision, despite the criticism of climate exaggerators. That, Gaetz notes, is the logical conclusion of the paper of record's decision to bring on a science denier after the election in the guise of promoting a free exchange of ideas. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Listeners may know the Washington Post gave itself a motto recently, "Democracy dies in darkness." Outlets like The Post are talking a pretty good game these days about defending the public interest and the public's right to accurate information. But it's difficult to see how the paper can believe it's serving either of those goals with its new series on Social Security disability benefits and beneficiaries. Here to help us see what's going on in this series is Rebecca Vallis. She's managing director for the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Rebecca Vallis.
Thanks so much for having me on, and especially on such an important and poorly covered topic.
Well, I know that you have spent a lot of time working on issues of Social Security disability insurance and supplemental security income for workers with disabilities in particular, so I can only imagine what journalism like this calls up for you. If you could start with the first installment in this Post series, we've seen two so far. The first one ran in late March. For those who didn't see it, tell us what story the Post was presenting under the headline, "Disabled or Just Desperate?"
I think it is important to start with the first piece, because this is the Washington Post launching a massive and deeply invested in year-long series on Social Security disability, and in particular focusing on receipt of disability benefits in rural America. Following up on November's election, that's their focus. What's going on in rural America, where we know voters disproportionately place their bets on Trump? So that first installment in this series, Disabled or Just Desperate, painted an incredibly bleak picture of rural America. It was sort of a dystopian portrait of Social Security disability benefits out of control, everyone on disability. That was the conclusion a reader would come away with. Unfortunately, what that piece really did was to perpetuate so many myths and stereotypes about these programs and their beneficiaries. The facts here were what was glaringly missing from this coverage, and that's true in both pieces. For example, that it's hard to qualify for benefits, that the vast majority of people who apply are actually denied, and that benefits are incredibly modest and very hard to live on. The fact that the United States has the strictest disability standard in the entire developed world, all of that missing, and instead this picture of everyone supposedly receiving disability benefits because they have lost their jobs and have nothing else to turn to.
Well, that piece did have a central assertion, which was that one-third of working-age adults in rural communities are living on disability checks. One-third. And when you all looked into that, I mean, it wasn't just that the piece had depressing anecdotes and some very frustrating tropes and all of that, but this central assertion turns out to be way off the mark.
That's exactly right. There was sort of this first cut where we all read it, and a lot of folks who know the facts and who know these programs and said, whoa, this is really misleading. But our economists here at the Center for American Progress took a really close look at the numbers in that story underpinning what you just said, the claim that as many as 1 in 3 Americans, working age Americans in rural America, are supposedly receiving disability benefits. And what we found is that that allegation was actually true nowhere in this country, and the closest that you're able to get to it is in one single county, one county in the entire United States where it's even close to true. And actually, the average percentage in the rural counties that the Post looks at of working-age folks receiving disability benefits is about 9%, a lot less dramatic and a lot less clickbait when you actually use numbers in a meaningful and accurate way.
Well, just to underscore, they chose for their site of their reporting a county that had a disproportionately high rate. Isn't that right?
That's exactly right. And actually, one of the counties with some of the highest rates of disability benefit receipt in the country. So it's hard not to view that as cherry picking.
Exactly. Well, okay. And so, you know, they run actually a correction because they no, they got some facts wrong, but even then they're still wrong in the premise and sort of the thrust of the piece. But one crosses their fingers for the next installment, and then we get the next installment, Generations Disabled. What can you tell us about that piece?
Well, I have to say, I was crossing my fingers with the rest of us all saying, you know what, the Post realizes that they screwed up. They took tremendous amounts of criticism after that first piece. Disability organizations, organizations like CAP, organizations like the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, all raising their voices saying, wait a second, let's zoom out and actually look at the facts here. And so I think there was some level of hope that, well, maybe their second piece in this series was going to be a little bit more careful, a little bit less of that sort of mean-spirited stereotype peddling that we saw with the first. But unfortunately, and I've uncrossed my fingers now having read the second piece is even more cartoonish and offensive than the first. What it paints is a picture not just of a culture of disability like the first piece, but rather it makes much of the fact that there might be families in the United States of America, multi-generational families, where more than one person receives disability benefits. But backing up to what makes the way that it painted that picture so deeply offensive, even in just the subhead of the article, before you even get to the article itself, it goes so far as to allege that families pray, literally the word pray, for their loved ones and their children to become sick or disabled in hopes of receiving benefits. Well, I've got news for the Washington Post. Nobody prays for disability or for illness on their own part or on the part of their children or their families. It's really a disgusting and deeply offensive allegation, and not even one that's even supported by their own reporting. They follow a family, again, sort of anecdote-based journalism like the first, but they follow a family with multiple people in the household who have disabilities, and they speak with the mother who says that she's been praying for the right diagnosis, which for folks who understand the reality of caring for children with disabilities and seeking to get them the best medical care that you can, praying for the right diagnosis is absolutely what many folks end up having to do so that they can get their children the care that they need. need. One of the most important pieces of information that this second installment in the series is missing, it actually is even featured in a data sidebar, but is not contemplated anywhere in the piece itself. And that's that disability often runs in families. There are a lot of reasons for that, and particularly in rural America, whether it's because siblings may experience similar disabilities due to genetics or shared exposure to environmental hazards or common barriers to health care. Maybe there are doctor shortages or lack of health insurance. Lots of reasons why this happens. And yet, through this sort of anecdote-driven journalism devoid of key facts and context, we see this damning portrait of disability benefits that really risks tremendous consequences. And I hope we can get into that as well.
Well, that's just where I wanted to go, because it's poor journalism, and we can see that on a number of levels, but it's also dangerous, as you point out. And what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, so there are a lot of reasons why this kind of reporting is not just offensive, not just misleading, but that it actually really does risk having very real, very human consequences for the worse. And we need to look no further than 1996, when Congress moved forward and Bill Clinton signed into law something that today is usually referred to as welfare reform, but which was a massive slashing and structural change to our cash assistance system in this country. Leading up to that, what we saw was a flurry of news reports that gave birth to the myth of the welfare queen, this concept that President Reagan popularized and then sort of became the story that wouldn't go away, this concept of a single mom, very racialized concept, usually a mom of color with many children and who was popping out babies, supposedly, to get those quote-unquote welfare checks. What we saw was the evisceration of cash assistance for poor families with children in this country, very much driven by that flurry of news reports that drove not just public misunderstanding of income assistance in this country, but also really in many ways congressional heat that members of Congress on a bipartisan basis felt they had to address. So what we are currently watching right now is 1996 all over again, but with that myth of the welfare queen now transposed onto the face of people who need to turn to disability benefits. And this is a very timely conversation to be having as we stare down the barrel of President Trump's proposed budget, and in a couple of weeks, congressional Republicans moving forward with their own budget. Trump's budget slashed the very parts of Social Security that people with disabilities, like the ones highlighted in this reporting, rely on to keep a roof over their heads and food on the table. And so what this kind of misleading and myth-based reporting risks doing is giving cover to slash those vital programs, even though it isn't something that the American people are asking for until they're force-fed these myths to weaken support for these programs.
We've been speaking with Rebecca Vallis. She's managing director for the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress. Rebecca Vallis, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me back.
In a TV debate with Democrat John Ossoff, Georgia Republican Karen Handel said, quote, "This is an example of a fundamental difference between a liberal and a conservative. I do not support a livable wage," close quote. Many people remarked on what was called a gaffe, but some took pains to make clear that it was just a matter of awkward phrasing. What she could have and should have said, counseled New York Magazine's Ed Kilgore, is that a $15 per hour minimum wage, the most commonly advanced Democratic proposal, was too high for a place like Atlanta, with its relatively low cost of living. CNN pointed out that Handel's remark went viral despite her follow-up, which was that she instead wants, quote, "an economy that is robust with low taxes and regulation," close quote. Democrats are jumping on Handel for her words, CNN says, and they cite a tweet from Tom Perez saying those words prove she has no business being in Congress. But Perez's tweet comes with the article, and it actually reads, quote, "If Karen Handel doesn't support a living wage for working Americans, she has no business being in Congress," close quote. It seems many in corporate media have a hard time believing that anyone would be outraged that someone doesn't support a living wage, however they say it. Because the idea that raising the minimum wage is controversial, that it kills jobs and hurts business, is such a hardy media perennial. We talked about the myths and misinformation surrounding the living wage over a year ago with economist Holly Sklar. She's the author of Raise the Floor, Wages and Policies That Work for All of Us, and she's CEO of a group called Business for a Fair Minimum Wage. Here again is our still relevant conversation with Holly Sklar. Well, I don't think anyone truly believes that Walmart would have to go out of business if they paid workers more. It seems like more an ideological argument that if they can make a squillion dollars, then they're entitled to every penny. But the rhetoric often tells us that it's the smaller businesses that would suffer, that wouldn't be able to hire or wouldn't be able to grow. And that seems to be what you're countering fairly directly.
Yes. That in general, we know that it's absolutely the case that you cannot build a strong economy on a falling wage floor, and the minimum wage adjusted for the cost of living has fallen dramatically. At the federal level, $7.25 is actually lower, adjusted for inflation, than the minimum wage of 1950, and it's a third lower than 1968. And so you cannot build a strong economy, and you cannot really build a strong business for the long haul on falling real wages. Most businesses in the country are small businesses. And so, by definition, most of our members are small businesses, although we have some very large businesses as well. And we have business alliances, for example, the Greater New York Chamber of Commerce, which represents about 30,000 business works raising minimum wage. Small businesses understand very well that workers are also consumers. If there's not enough money in the wage base of the economy of the people that they're hoping will come in and buy their goods and services, they feel it every day. And they also feel very directly what it's like to have a worker who, if they're underpaid, if they're not really earning enough to even keep a roof overhead, put food on the table, buy the winter jacket of a growing kid, they're distracted by these financial stress that's continual. And so they believe very strongly that the workers should earn enough so that they can focus on the business, on the customer, and not be constantly worried about just how are they going to make ends meet, how are they going to make the rent, and so on.
Well, you've just talked about the history, and I think it's interesting. Donald Trump and his ilk seem to connect holding down wages to this idea of making America great again. And that's more than ironic given the actual history.
Yeah, well, my point is that's a big myth that has been sold. I mean, if cutting wages and cutting benefits and cutting just this whole notion that the more you can squeeze out of the worker at the same time as in the giant corporation, not the small businesses, but in the bigger corporation, you go in the exact opposite way and you have more and more of the revenue of the company going to fewer and fewer hands at the top. You know, we've already tested that. That's my point. That model is delivering us worse economic growth. That model is giving us a shrinking middle class, and that model is what produced the greatest economic meltdown since the Great Depression. There's nothing theoretical about that. We have seen what this business model and this economic model produces, and it's terrible. It's terrible for workers, and it's also terrible for most businesses. The biggest thing businesses have complained about in recent years is that they're just not seeing enough consumer demand. They're not seeing enough consumer buying power. They need more. You know, you need people to buy what they're making in order to sustain the business and to grow the business. And there's obviously a direct connection, or I say obviously, but the folks like Donald Trump doesn't, you know, ideologically they don't want to see it as obvious. You need people to have enough wages to be able to buy what they need. And if you're going to have a growing middle class, you need people to be able to buy more than just the bare necessities, right? And that's what we've lost sight of.
And yet you can, you know, open any paper and find somebody saying, well, yes, you know, ideally workers might make more, but the tough reality is if companies raise wages, they won't, that will lead to joblessness, you know, that jobs will be destroyed. And they present studies and numbers and charts that seem to make that argument. Is it really something where the economics are debated or highly contentious of how this would work?
at our website, businessforafairminimumwage.org, is actually a research summary, the most rigorous research on whether the raising the minimum wage causes job loss. And it does not. In other words, if you look at all the actual minimum wage increases in recent decades, so not projecting forward and saying based on my particular, often ideological driven economic assumptions going forward, but if I'm looking back and looking at actual minimum wage increases and not being simplistic and like saying, I'll just pretend that there wasn't an economic meltdown in 2008 when I'm looking at, you know, what's the consequence of the minimum wage, but factoring things out. Anyway, the point is that this rigorous research of actual minimum wage increases really does show that there is either no effect or a slightly positive effect, or in some cases slightly negative, but when you look at it overall, on balance, does not cause job loss. Just in the last year or two, the states that have raised their minimum wage are actually showing stronger job growth. Now, I'm saying that that's not one of these rigorous studies. There's a reason for this. There's this direct connection between you can't expect people to buy what's being produced by business to continue to buy that at that level or more if you're driving down wages. It doesn't work. And one of the ways that this was masked for a while was people were using their home equity, for example, going deeper into debt to try and get by when wages were going down to continue to maintain living standards. That masked it for a while. But as we know well, that doesn't last forever. And we saw the consequences in the economic meltdown.
Well, just finally making the argument that a higher minimum wage is good for business doesn't preclude the social justice argument that people simply deserve to be able to survive on their paycheck, does it?
No. If you work a full-time job, you shouldn't be earning a poverty wage. I mean, it's as simple as that. You know, you shouldn't be earning a poverty wage in general. But of course, if you work full-time, at the end of the month, it should add up to what you need to pay rent and the other basics that you have. And the other thing, if I could just add, because this is important as to why so many of our business people feel very strongly about this, is businesses that are using this better business model as one that invests in their workers, they really see things like stronger productivity, stronger customer service. They see dramatic reductions often in worker turnover. So there are all these factors that are also internal to the business that bring real improvements in just the way the business is operating. That really is important for your bottom line as well.
We've been speaking with Holly Sklar of Business for a Fair Minimum Wage. They're online at businessforafairminimumwage.org. Holly Sklar, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.